Okay, well, thanks very much. I think thanks very much for inviting me to give the Blackboard talk. We'll see at the end of the hour if I'm actually grateful. So what I'd like to tell you about is some of the issues that are, that we've been trying to tackle in the complex fluids part of the ITP program. And of course, I'm going to tell you some of these issues through my point of view. So the other softies that are in the audience can straighten me out if they like. But I'm going to give you sort of my take on what's some of the most important and, well, most interesting to me aspects of the effects of flow, in particular, strong flow fields on complex fluids. And so what I will do, let me just give you a brief outline that I'll keep up here. First, I'll just give an introduction to what I mean by complex fluids, which is most of what you guys are eating and what is inside you, but it comprises polymers, soaps, fats, mixtures of different fluids. And I want to try to explain how I look at complex fluids, anticipating what's going to happen when we put them into flow fields. Okay, then I want to show you some experiments. Okay, so we'll retreat from the blackboard and go to the overhead for just a little while, and I'll show you some of the interesting experiments that happen when you shear, say, a polymer solution or a soap solution, and you look at it very closely to see what happens. And we'll see that you can actually induce a variety of macroscopic changes both in the structure, that is, if you send x-rays through it, you'll see a liquid-like structure factor go to a crystalline-like structure factor. Or if you look at the response function, so the analog of looking at the susceptibility in a magnetic system, you'll see a dramatic increase as if you're going perhaps through a critical point or signifying a change of phase from one state to another. So what we'd like to do is try to explain or rationalize what we see. So then I will discuss some of the issues in constructing the dynamics. And when I say dynamics, I mean the proper theoretical description for how we describe what's going on in the complex fluids. And then I'll get to what I think will be the meat of what I want to try to go through, which is if we take the set of dynamical equations which we can derive, and I'm not going to go through the very interesting and difficult procedure of trying to derive equations. That's the subject of actually much of the next couple weeks in the complex fluids program. But I'm going to look at if we know what the dynamics are, what can we do with that to try to understand the I'll put it in quotations, thermodynamics of flow-induced transitions. That is, just like one learns in elementary thermodynamics, once you learn about the Gibbs potential, you can hook up the chemical potential and construct the rules for phase diagrams. What I'd like to look at is, if we have the equations of motion, how do we do the analog procedure when we're out of equilibrium? How can we construct some kind of phase diagram to rationalize what we see under flow? Of course, it's not a true phase diagram in the sense of equilibrium statistical mechanics. There will not be a singularity in a partition function or anything like that. But nonetheless, we can actually do the thermodynamics without knowing about the partition function. So that's sort of the style in which I want to go through it. And this is going to, actually, even without knowing too much about how one gets at the equations of motion, there are some fundamental surprises and differences between the equilibrium and non-equilibrium systems that I want to highlight. And then I'm going to try to come back to reality. That is, experiments are going to complicate things. So I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about, in an ideal case, where one is induced to transition between one phase flowing, say, with one viscosity, in another phase with another viscosity, how can we rationalize it? But then we'll see that, if we get that far, that if you look at the experiments, it may be that this simple picture needs an awful lot of working through to actually make it work. Okay, and that'll probably take me to the end of the time. Okay, so what do we mean by complex fluids? There's a variety of different animals that we can throw into a solvent. And so a polymer solution is an example. So since we're an Institute for Theoretical Physics, I don't need to draw the carbons and hydrogen bonds. I can represent a polymer as a nice flexible strand. There are surfactants. And a surfactant is a very interesting object, or because it's got a head group which likes the water and a tail group which doesn't like the water, which is hydrophilic. So this is hydrophobic. That's hydrophilic. Thank you. And that's hydrophobic. And if you put these into water, what you will find is that it will self-assemble. And you'll get a variety of different phases where the tail groups are shielded away from the water by the head groups. And these can go from micellar phases to lamellar phases, and a whole variety of different structures. Okay? So that's a flexible chain, surfactants. We have liquid crystals. And these are rigid rods. Again, as a theorist cartoon. And these undergo a variety of symmetry breaking transitions where they can line up into a pneumatic state or into a smectic state, so in a pneumatic state you've just broken the orientational order, so that's one symmetry breaking transition, but you've retained the translational disorder and you can go down further and break one dimensional translational order to get a layered state. And there are a variety of phase transitions that show up in smectic, so it's actually quite a nice playground to do statistical mechanics on. Colloids. So essentially just suspensions, no longer of rod-like particles, but just of, say, spherical particles. And there's been a lot of work in looking at colloids as model atoms, but very big atoms. So they're using plastic beads in suspension, and by coating the plastic beads, say with little polymer hairs, or putting charges on them, you can tune the interaction potentials between the colloids and essentially design any kind of interatomic in quotations, any interatomic potential that you like, and you can examine new forms of liquids or the absences of liquids that you might not find in normal atomic liquids.
Any?
Okay, maybe not any, so.
But what is the range of
potentials? H bar is equal to zero, so no quantum liquids.
But what range of potentials can you?
Okay, so you can go from a range of potentials where is obviously specified, limited by the long hairs that you can put on, so about microns, and then you can tune this to be smoothly to a hard core, and you can go from one to the other. And of course, in the hard core, you don't have a liquid phase. You can, very interestingly, as you turn up the attractive well, you can look at the emergence of a liquid phase, which is quite interesting. Okay. So those are the main players, and I'll show you some experiments on surfactant systems, essentially soap and water mixed together, some experiments on colloidal systems, perhaps some experiments on polymer systems when subjected to flow. Okay, so let me say a couple words about the two ways to view the condensed complex fluid systems, anticipating what happens when you put them into flow. The two main issues, or two viewpoints. The systems that I've shown you have a variety broken symmetry, a variety of broken symmetry transitions. In the liquid crystalline systems, you can break orientational translational order. in the surfactant systems and in other polymer systems I haven't told you about, you can also induce liquid order and crystalline order of different symmetries. And this is important when putting into a flow field, because we're typically going to talk about a flow field which has biaxial symmetry. So any phase transition that you have in equilibrium will automatically be subjected to some interesting set of symmetry breaking transition or changes in symmetry due to the applied flow. And another issue is the issue of self-assembly. What I should first say is that the broken symmetry issues are quite fairly easy to understand. That is, if I have, say if I start with a disordered liquid crystal phase, there it is, and I subject it to flow. So I shear it from top and bottom. What the flow will tend to do is align these objects. That's not very nice. We'll align these objects up so that they're more or less aligned along the flow transition. So it's fairly easy to see that a disordered state subjected to flow will have a perturbation which tends to try to push it over the edge into a transition if it's near an equilibrium transition. A more nebulous issue, which is I think complicating the issue for a lot of the experiments, is self-assembly. So in a lot of systems, the surfactants can self-assemble, say, into these little micelles, and the simplest micelle is a spherical object, and that spherical object just floats around. If you have higher concentrations and you play with the chemistry, this micelle can elongate and become a cylindrical object, and so the chemistry is such that it doesn't like to make the high curvature of the ends, but it doesn't mind having the cylindrical edge. And this object, these can grow quite long in the soap solution. And the problem is that this is a dynamic equilibrium because it's always exchanging surfactant with the outside environment. Now, when you subject this object to flow, you might imagine that it becomes aligned. But you might also imagine, and I think this is what's happening a lot, that you're changing the equilibrium between the surfactants that are outside and the surfactants that are inside. The ones floating around feet free, which are very few, and the ones floating around in the micelle. You'll also be changing the length. So we have a pretty good idea of how to handle both of these kinds of systems in equilibrium. We can do the statistical mechanics for the broken symmetry transitions fairly easily. You can write down a Landau theory if you know about the symmetries of the transition. And microscopically, you can there are a variety of theories from which one can derive the free energy, if you like. Self-assembly, again, one has a reasonable idea, but one is on a little bit less sure footing, particularly about how to handle the entropy of the self-assembly, because you might have objects of different sizes. So we're on somewhat reasonable ground theoretically here, although people typically are finding new phases all the time. In this case, you've got to sort of dream up configurations that you wouldn't have dreamed up, and we go to nature to find out what shows up. There was an interesting sort of historical, I guess it's historical by now, event that occurred in the block copolymer literature or history recently, where the block copolymer, it's like a polymeric surfactant where you chemically tie together two polymers, which do not like each other. And so if you put these together that don't like each other, they will try to separate into phases which are segregated and the symmetry of the segregated shape of the segregated phase depends on the shapes of the two different polymers. If one is very long and one is very small, you might get a symmetry which is micellar, like this form. If they're roughly the same shape, you'll get something which is a layered form. And in between the cylindrical form and the layered form, there turns out to be a cubic phase, a phase of cubic symmetry, which was misinterpreted for many years because we just didn't dream of one, of what the right symmetry was. I think that's the right way to think about it. So self-assembled systems are really tough to deal with theoretically. And the unfortunate thing is that most of the interesting self-behavior of materials under flow turns out to be these. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about is I'm going to show you some experiments on various complex fluids subjected to flow, and I'm going to tell you about a very simple ideas of theories to try to understand these. Most of the theories in the back of my mind, in the back of our minds, have been based on dynamics where one basically has a broken symmetry transition, and you don't worry about self-assembly or the effect of flow on self-assembly. If you have a broken symmetry transition, okay, liquid crystalline, where you're just changing the orientation of the objects or the deformation of the objects, you're not worrying about how they assemble. In that case, it's relatively easy to come up with the dynamics. Unfortunately, most systems seem to be here. Okay, so that's I'm anticipating my punchline at the end, but I just want to be honest to tell you where we're going to go. Okay. So what will happen when we put these in flow? If we have a liquid crystal, you would imagine that you line them up, just like a magnetic field lines up a paramagnet. If you have some objects which can self-assemble, you might imagine that you can increase or you can decrease the degree of self-assembly. Okay, so what will that do? So if we put the complex fluids into flow, what do we expect to happen? Okay, if we put them in flow, we've got to measure them. Okay, so the typical thing that one does, and this is a theorist version of what's typical, is you have two flat plates. You move the plates relative to each other with some gap velocity. And say that we have a gap size of L, that means we'll have a rate of strain, call it gamma dot, which is the difference in velocities over the gap side. And I'm always going to work in the notation where I've got a velocity field in the x direction, which has a gradient as a function of y. And so what do? We subject our complex fluid to this kind of a flow field, and we'd like to probe it. We can probe it by looking at the structure. The simplest probe is actually to measure the force response. So we measure the stress, the force per unit area, as a function of the rate of strain. And in the case of a typical Newtonian fluid, one will get a slope, which is the viscosity, the d sigma d gamma dot. And that's a very boring fluid. Now, if we put in a fluid that can respond to the flow, so if I have a polymer solution, the polymer will go from being a disordered coil, which would be its equilibrium state, which would have some viscosity. If you shear it enough, you stretch this coil out, and if it's stretched out, it doesn't have the opportunity to entangle as much with its neighbors. And so you expect it to be able to slip a little bit easier past its neighbors. So you generally might expect that you have a Newtonian regime for some range of strain rates. And then as soon as you stretch it out, it starts to decreased relative to what it would be if it was completely disordered. And so this would be a shear thinning. Shear thinning situation. Okay, and this is quite common in polymer melts and in many complex fluids. And the idea is you perturb the structure. If you go beyond the linear regime, the structure reacts back on the flow and then reduces the effective stress. You can get the opposite. Shear thinning is reasonably well understood in a lot of cases. You can get shear thickening, and that might happen where if you have coagulation, so you have the cases where monomers can react with each other to form dimers. And this may be an equilibrium reaction, which is, has forward reaction and back reaction under flow. This could be if you have sticky spheres or spheres that are close to each other. If you turn up the flow, you enhance the collision rate. So what you might expect to happen is that in the presence of flow, on average, you've got more of the dimers than you had in the absence of flow. So that would correspond to a case where you turn up the flow and then you enhance the presence of these larger objects, which can present a more stiffer response, and you get a shear thickening transition. Okay, so as I say, this is a cartoon, and not that much is understood theoretically about how to get a satisfactory shear thickening equations. Okay. Now this is just perturbative. What might we expect to find if we get some sort of a runaway effect? Let me just look at the analog with equilibrium. Pardon? So in this case, I imagine, so for example, I have my plates and I shear them at a given speed. So if I have a very low shear rate, and what you need to do is you really should be comparing that to some intrinsic relaxation time associated with the material. So if you're at a shear rate which is lower than the time for, say, the polymers to snap back to their overall isotropic state, then you won't see much of an effect. But if you can shear faster than they can respond, then they will end up being stretched out, and then you'll get a deviation.
But that relaxation time has nothing to do with the rates that enter in the forward-backward reaction.
In the case of coagulation, the relaxation time would be actually related to the forward and backward reaction rate. Yep.
Are those breaks in the slope, are there kinks in the slope or smooth turnover?
In this case, you have smooth turnover. What I will show you in just a second is that if you take it to the extreme, you can actually get kinks in non-analytic behavior. That's right. So.
And if you get your phase transitions, like you get the crystal kinks, you can get kinks.
Yep. Yeah. So let me just, that's what I was going to do next. But if we just look at the magnet analogy. Can I draw that the right way? If I have a magnet and I apply a magnetic field, I've got magnetic field on that axis, but I've got that for a reason. You'll have a linear slope similar to the slope between stress and rate of strain, and that slope will be the related to the inverse susceptibility. Okay, and in fact, you can look at the slope between the stress and, in fact, the local strain as the effect, the modulus, the time-dependent modulus, has exactly the same behavior as the susceptibility for a magnetic system. So you can apply all the machinery of linear response theory to the flow-induced, to the systems under flow. If we're not near a paramagnetic state, but we're in the ferromagnetic state, then if we look at the magnetic field and the magnetization, then you get something like that, where for positive magnetic fields, you get a finite and non-zero magnetization, and for lower magnetic fields, you have a finite negative magnetization, and you have this van der Waals loop type behavior. And of course, at the origin, the susceptibility has the wrong sign because it's a negative slope, and it's become quite sick. And if you force the system to lie here, it will separate into domains, different degrees of magnetization. So it's suggestive of, can we take the flow, other systems such that the flow curve, stress as a function of rate of strain, exhibits a similar intrinsic instability. That is, if you had a flow curve that looked like that, which has a similar loop as in the magnetic field case, then in fact, that point would be unstable. And it would be unstable in the same sense that the magnetic system is unstable here.
But only that point?
This whole range. Line, no? This whole range, yeah. So the analog of the convexity inequalities for equilibrium, which tell you about the stability. So if you look at the dynamical equations of motion, which I'll write down in a bit, this portion of the flow curve is unstable because if you sit it there, the stress can reduce and the strain rate can increase and it can accelerate. You get a runaway instability. Okay. So it's natural to ask, if you're in the business of asking about finding transitions out of equilibrium, if one can find this type of behavior in complex fluids.
So this one determines a mixed curve.
So this would determine, if so in here, yeah. Pardon? Sorry?
In that region, the system is in a mixed phase.
Here, yes.
Here, but the level for what happens in that phase.
Yeah, so what we would like to see if that actually occurs as well. So is there going to be a lever rule that says if you force the system to be there, here it's unstable, so you might expect it to break up into someone with one strain rate and something with another strain rate, which would then be filling up the gap. One strain right there and another strain right there. That's exactly right. I can answer more questions on this. I want to show some experiments as well, which will.
You label both of your handouts A in both pictures, so just
did I? Oh, there were A and A were there, weren't they? Very observant there, Dave. Okay, so let me show some experimental pictures. It should be in focus. Okay, so this is a well-used transparency, as you can see. This is a phase diagram for one of these worm-like micelles. So it's a soap solution in water plus some salt that self-assembles into these cylindrical micelles. And they're very polymeric-like. That is, they can be quite long, up to microns in size, at the extreme case. And they have quite a complicated phase diagram as a function of composition. They can either be an isotropic, so semi-dilute, overlapping phase, where you get these long polymeric objects that overlap. They can be very dilute, down at low concentrations. Here they have a columnar pneumatic phase at high concentrations, and an even higher phase concentrations as a hexagonal phase where the pneumatics become aligned with hexagonal. So the axes are, so this is the volume fraction of this salt, the counter ion that's put in, and this is the axis of the concentration of soap. So essentially you play, the soap is charged, it will ionize, and you put a counter ion in which also ionizes, and then they incorporate together. So if you look at these under the microscope, this is the kind of thing you find. So scale bar is 100 nanometers, and I can't see it from this close, but you can see that there are these string-like objects that are overlapping. In this particular case, the arrows are supposed to be pointing out branched objects, whether one believes these are branched or not. I mean, there's raging argument as whether you can get branched polymers, branched worm-like micelles. Okay. Oh, this is a nice picture down here, so you can see the mess of soap solution. So what we want to do is subject this to shear flow. So if you apply shear to it, you line these up. They're going to line up because of the self-assembly aspect, they're going to be breaking perhaps more, perhaps less. There's a bag of them, which is very nice. This is where they phase separated out, and they're in coexistence with the solvent-rich phase. Okay. So when these are subjected to flow, this is the kind of thing that's found. So this is the shear stress as a function of shear rate. And you have a Newtonian regime. This is log-log, but if you figure out, look at the slope, this is basically Newtonian. But then above some shear rate, there's an observable plateau. And to answer the question in the back, you can see it's definitely a kink here. And so this is obtained after waiting for a long time for each point. Just like you would do in a magnetic system, you waited a long time to get rid of any hysteresis that's there in the system. And it wasn't realized until late-ish in the game that one had to really worry about hysteresis effects. But they're definitely there. And so there's a kink. And so if you observe these, so this is sort of the first generation of observations of these systems. We heard last week about the second generation, which I won't subject people to, which says that this simple picture has to be modified. But the first generation of observations has told us that as you move across this stress plateau, so there's the plateau, as you move across the plateau, a band of well-oriented material develops and then moves across the system and then completely filling the gap until it goes up along the high shear rate plateau, the high shear rate branch. Question?
I'm very confused. I would have thought that the dynamics would be similar to nucleation and then percolation at this moment.
Mm. The dynamics probably is. These are steady state flow curves.
So this is a very long time.
Yeah, so what's happened is what they do is they've imposed the rate of strain, and this is the kind of, so they impose the rate of strain, say over here, and they measure the shear stress as a function of time. What typically happens is the shear stress goes up to some point on this purple branch, and it stays there for some time. Some nucleation event occurs, and it's not really understood how this process occurs. And then the system gradually adjusts itself, the stress relaxes, and then it comes back down onto this plateau. And so this plateau is very special. In this case, you can only reach it under controlled strain rate conditions. If you impose the stress, what happens is the system typically waits there for a while and then jumps over and makes it. It's as if you've applied the pressure to reduce the system below the liquid vapor transition, and it's all nucleated and turned to liquid. But the imposed strain rate is like imposing a constant volume constraint. And as you change the strain rate, it gradually does a conversion of one phase to the other. So those are the worm-like micelles that are very sort of semi-dilute. If you look at extremely dilute worm-like micelles, you get something else very strange. Instead of getting a plateau which is horizontal, you get a plateau, which is not really a plateau, you get an S-shaped curve where the system folds back on itself. And it's important to realize that this, the way you access it, is similar to the way you access the other plateau, in the sense that you have to be careful what you're controlling. If you control the rate of strain, then when you go above a critical rate of strain, the stress will increase by roughly an order of magnitude, and something happens inside the soap solution and it converts into a very thick material which has a much higher stress. If, on the other hand, you impose the stress, once you get above a critical stress, the system seems to convert gradually. And so you can increase the stress up here, and it will again be in a two-phase region, which is analogous to the two-phase region that we saw before. That is, you get something which is quite, there it is, analogous to this state. And I won't show you the optics for this because they're a little bit messier and they're looking from the other side. But qualitatively, what they find is when they're up here and stepping back So the strain rate is reducing is that it's nucleated some kind of gel-like material near the inner wall, and that amount of gel material moves across the sample as it converts it all into this thick material, and then it can continue up along the upper flow branch. Okay. Why this happens, well, we don't have very much idea. I think this is, in fact, just like moving across the plateau. You might think it's like the supercooled, but I think this is exactly like moving across the plateau. And this is one of the differences from liquid vapor that we'll find, is that in liquid vapor, or in a thermodynamic system, there's a rule that says the plateau has to have a given slope. There is no such rule here, so you are, in fact, allowed to have things with strange slopes. Yeah, we'll talk about the Maxwell construction, but they're...
And what's particularly odd is it looks like it's the control parameter that takes you along that slope is actually an intensive quantity as opposed to an extensive quantity, which you'd expect from the...
Yeah, we'll get onto that as well, yeah.
In the pictures, that what's lower down, is there some reason why it splits into two domains and not more, or why the light-up phase is lower?
In this particular case, there's probably a good reason, and the reason is you can see the slight curvature here. And this is actually two counter-rotating cylinders, and one's looking sort of down the axis in the gap between the cylinders. And because of the curvature, what you end up getting is instead of a homogeneous stress across the gap in steady state, you end up getting a curvature in the stress, an inhomogeneous stress. So you have a higher stress here than you have on the outside. And so it's as if taking the liquid vapor coexistence and putting it in a gravity field, so it's all sediments in the bottom.
So thinking in the language of the mixed phase, there is something which is driving one piece of the mixed phase off one side and the other.
In this particular case, yeah. Yeah. That's right. And that's a feature. I mean, it's a good thing to have here, but it can also be a bug if you want to look at things that are independent of gravity. I mean, in binary phase separation, people send things up into space to get rid of gravity. I mean, we'd like to invent, and there are rheometers where one can get rid of the curvature to try to look at. The solvent is at some temperature, and this is all highly temperature dependent. So if you change the temperature, you can move this plateau up, you can get rid of it completely. Yeah, so it's all temperature dependent. So that's one system. Okay, we can go on and on, and I'm not going to go on and on too far. But there's another system which has been studied quite a bit. Now the beginning. So again, this is a self-assembled system. So it's surfactants in solution, this time mixed with oils and waters, so that they self-assemble into layers, and I should have oil inside the layer, so the tail groups have oil in there, there's water outside, and so it's at the composition where it's self-assembled into a layered structure. Now you impose shear on a layered structure. If it's a disordered layer structure, the first thing you expect to happen is the layers all line up. Okay, you shear it, the layers will all line up, and you'd think, well, that's the end of it. Okay, and that's the end of it for a little while, actually not very far. And so at low shear rates, this is a Newtonian regime, which corresponds to reasonably ordered lamellae. They do have a fair amount of defects. So if you resolve it using scattering of various techniques or conductivity, you can see that there's a certain fraction of defects. Above some critical value of either the stress or the rate of strain, in fact, one might expect it's the rate of strain based on that plot. Above a critical rate of strain, these lamellae change their topology, and they actually roll up into multi-lamellar vesicles, which have been called onions because of the concentric structure. And the onions persist in this part of the phase. This is stress versus rate of strain. The onions persist for this range of strain rates with the onion size changing as a function of shear rate. The higher you shear it, the smaller the onion size will get. And you can, if you shear it enough, the onion becomes unstable again. And you can see there's a plateau up here which is in fact a coexistence in the same way that we saw for the worm-like micelles, a coexistence between onion phase and a phase of well-ordered lamellae or other well-ordered phase. Okay. And we know that they're onions. So this is done by Didier Roux, who is over there. We know they're onions because if you stop the shear and you look at them, you get this nice, this is a freeze fracture picture. And I don't know if it shows up, but there are, you can see some individual layers within the onion. And I guess the size is of order microns. Is that right, PDA? Yeah, so the size of these is of order microns. And so this nice lamella structure has been drastically changed by the shear.
You stop the shear and freeze it?
So you stop the shear and then you stick it in liquid nitrogen, something like that. Freeze it in. And then you need to go through it. And so you can see little pockets where the knife came through, just popped out. Onions. Okay. There are transitions where these onions undergo a transition between small onions and large onions, small hexagonally ordered onions and large onions, with a plateau in the phase diagram of one way or another. Okay. So I'm not going to go any further with the onions. One can go a long ways looking at them. For something a little bit different, if we look at so this is taken from a talk last week, actually, Francois Molina, who's not here, so I can talk about his stuff. This is a block copolymer, which has a hydrophobic block in the middle and a hydrophilic blocks on the end. You throw it into water, and it will self-assemble to make a copolymer micelle. If you pack these at high concentrations, these micelles will order in, would like to order on a cubic array. And there's a phase diagram of these ordering as a function of concentration. When they subject these to shear, what they find is this ordered array undergoes what looked like a set of transitions. So this is the stress, again, as a function of shear rate. And here's one plateau, which turns out to be interpreted as a polydomain, so polycrystal phase, coexisting with micelles ordered in sheets. And then they order again. They go from being ordered in sheets one way to ordered in sheets the other way. Okay, so they have coexistence amongst the polydomains, and then the domains organize themselves into sheets, which can be oriented either in this orientation or in the other orientation. So there's a succession of phase transitions there. Okay, so I think that's it for what I want to say about the experiments. Are there any questions about experiments? We could go on and on, but so let me now go back to say, what can we say about it? Can we put it in a general framework? Okay, so we've seen one set of flow curves where the phase separates in this sense, and another set of flow curves where it seems to phase separate. This is a shear thickening case. So it phase separates by coming back on itself. So this was thinning, and this was thickening. Okay, and the question we'd like to ask is, can one pursue the analogy with phase transitions? And if so, what can we do about it? So how can we pursue the analogy? Okay, so the question is, So analogies with phase transitions. And we want to try to do this honestly. Okay, so what we need is, the first thing we need is we need equations of motion. And this is the toughest part of the job. Okay. I'm not going to say anything about deriving the equations of motion, except that it is important to look at the kind of variables that one typically will write equations of motion for. And that is, well, we need something that knows about the, say, the concentration or the volume fraction, because in all of these systems we've talked about something in solution. We need a constitutive relation that tells us how the stress in the system depends, for example, on the strain rate, and it will depend on the concentration. But there's usually something else, because these fluids all have structure in them. So there are typically structural variables that are in there, and I'll just call them Q. And I'll call them Q as a tensor, because the velocity field, that is the velocity gradient, can most easily be written as a tensor. In fact, most of the structural variables that one wants to look at turn out to be tensor variables. And so there'll be a constitutive relation as a function of this structural variable. And if we have a structural variable, we need to write an equation of motion for that. Yep?
Should I think of these as coarse-grained variables?
This is all at the level of coarse graining.
Peter, you don't include the velocity field itself as one of the variables in the list?
That's in here. I don't have an equation of motion for gamma dot. I could, but I'm going to work in the zero Reynolds number limit. But one should, in principle, have an equation of motion. That's absolutely right. And so kappa is the velocity gradient tensor. So one should, in principle, write that equation down as well. That's right.
Will these equations typically be dissipative?
They will have to be dissipative. That's a very good question, because this is all, I mean, dissipation is going on. Yeah. Let me come back to that in just a sec. So we need the equations of motion. Okay, and then we need to... Once we have the equations of motion, from these, we need to construct the constitutive curves. That is, maybe we've got a fluid which will do that at a given concentration, will do that at another concentration. If you put a structural variable into it, maybe it will thicken it into a gel, say above some critical stress. And there are a variety of constitutive curves. This is analogous to in equilibrium computing free energy as a function of various parameters from which one will calculate coexistence. So I want to calculate the coexistence curves, say sigma xy, as a function of gamma dot. And then we need to put them together, look at the form of the coexistence of the constitutive curves, and we need to determine the coexistence conditions. Okay. Yep.
Is there something whose variation will give these equations of motion?
No. And let me spend a little time on the equations of motion, because there's a lot of details in there. So you can't just use any equations of motion. You've got to obey a few rules, right?
I'm stopping from trying.
Yep, everyone tries to do it. Right. Okay, so in the simplest case, if we work in terms of coarse grain variables, which might not be the best thing to do, we will typically have a Navier-Stokes equation. And so I have the full convective derivative on the velocity field, which is the divergence of a stress tensor, which can depend on all the quantities that we have at our disposal. There will be a generally a diffusion equation on the concentration. It's the divergence of a current because it's a conserved quantity. And that current, you might say it's a mobility times the gradient of a free energy derivative. And this is definitely open for discussion when we're out of equilibrium and you might not be able to describe a free energy. And the tensorial equation of motion typically has a form, has a time derivative. Let me put the whole convective derivative down. So we have a time derivative acting on the whatever the structural parameter is. And then because it's a tensor, this gets back to putting any equations down, the thing that always emerges naturally is the antisymmetric part of the velocity gradient tensor. So this is like a co-rotational derivative. So what's important is actually the motion of the tensorial object relative to the background rotation. So it's got to be some gauge invariant in some way. And then that's typically related to the symmetric part. We may have an arbitrary prefactor, which I'll say a bit about. So this, all these terms are reversible because they have the same sign under time reversal. Move it forward, move it back. The rate of strain will pull the tensorial object forward. So these are the non-dissipative couplings. And a lot of work goes into trying to get these non-dissipative couplings. And there will generally be dissipative couplings, which schematically might govern the relaxation back to equilibrium of this object. Okay. This always appears because you always want to know about rotation relative to the background. This, in fact, this is one of many different reversible terms that can show up. And I don't want to go into the apparatus about how that comes about. But for example, at A is equal to 1 tells us that the tensorial object actually rotates in along streamlines. And if A is equal to minus 1, tells us it actually rotates with the normals of the streamlines, like covariant versus contravariant. Right. So Q might be, in the liquid crystal systems, it might be a sum over, say, the second moment of the, so if I have individual rods, I can describe them by an orientation vector. And what's important is not the direction of that, because up is the same as down. So I need to look at the second moment of that orientation vector. And if I subtract off the unity tensor, then that makes it zero when it's completely disordered. This is a local order parameter, yeah.
It's not zero in the nematic phase, it's zero when it's disordered.
That's right, yeah. And there are, and this is a sum over all molecules. You might have this be in a polymer, where you could describe the polymer by a position in space that depends on an arc length along the polymer. This thing might be the average of the correlation of the tangent vectors.
This last equation, if I say Halpern and Hohenberg, this last equation is like in their, one of their.
So this is model H here, and this is model H with an auxiliary non-conserved tensorial order parameter.
So that's a Poisson bracket.
And so this comes from a Poisson bracket, that's right. These two together, that's right. And when you do the Poisson bracket, there's a degeneracy when you have a tensorial object, so that there are many forms that can show up for this. It's non-unique. This form always shows up because of rotational invariance, but that one's non-unique, that's right.
Can you say something about
temperature and heat flow?
I didn't want to. but strictly speaking, we should augment this by heat flow equations. Well, whatever it is. We should put in heat flow. So we have a heat flow with a heat capacity and the divergence of a heat flux. And we need to expand this heat flux to include the dissipative contribution from viscosities and whatever's going on here. So strictly speaking, one should do that. And there is evidence that, of course, you are generating significant amounts of heat. And the steady state is only maintained by dumping heat out of the system. And so one should put that in.
What about homogeneity of temperature within the system?
It's going to be inhomogeneous. Most.
And you ignore that?
I ignore that. Yep. Yep. But I think it is important, actually, because what's happening is you'll get a temperature profile in steady state, which is hotter near the middle, colder near the outside. That could have significant effects when you're near a phase transition that's perturbed by temperature.
But you're a separation between two different phases. Mm-hmm. It might be a quite different temperature.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
What does that say when you have, if you've got the energy equation, then you have to start thinking about splitting up the free energy into genuine energy and entropy, and you call this an irreversible term. That becomes tricky, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does. I don't know if that's been sorted out by anyone, but that it
generic claims to.
Yeah, that's right. And so, okay, this is a long wavelength description in terms of the moments. That is, I've done it in terms of moments of some particular microscopic variables. You could also try to do it in terms of a Smoluchowski or Fokker-Planck equation approach, where you work with distribution functions for these quantities. It's obviously more unwieldy to deal with, and the big problem is that it doesn't handle spatial inhomogeneities, which are actually quite important. Okay. And so this includes dissipation. These have to be constructed properly so that you don't violate the second law, so the Onsager reciprocity relations hold. And there's a whole school called generic, all in capital letters, which is devoted to making sure that that's done properly, particularly for these tensorial order parameters. Okay. Now, naturally, I've gone through about 1/10 of what I wanted to do. So there are a variety of these models which produce a set of flow curves. And the one that we worked on most is a liquid crystal model, which predicts a transition from a less ordered phase, so the isotropic phase, to a pneumatic phase. For the purposes of trying to understand coexistence, that actually doesn't matter. We just need a constitutive model that will reproduce this kind of behavior. Now, if we have this kind of behavior, what can we do with it? So this tells us that we've got different stresses at which a system can coexist. So there's our interface between phase A and phase B. And let me just take a toy model. So in steady state, we would have 0 is the divergence of some stress tensor. Okay, if we put an interface along the y direction, what that tells us, well, the only gradient is in the y direction, so this tells us that we have sigma xy has to be uniform to satisfy the steady state condition from the Navier's, the momentum balance. This has to be uniform, and it has to be equal to some value. That is, it has to be come out to be the value that's measured in the experiments. So there's some sigma star, and I'll call it sigma star, that has to be there. So that's a constant. And this has to come from the constitutive equation. So this constitutive equation might be some homogeneous function, so that sigma h of gamma dot is just this S curve. So locally in space, whatever the strain rate is stress will be given by this constitutive curve. And if we have an interface between phases, then we can allow for gradients. And you can actually mock up a toy model. We just write it down for the purposes of understanding what's going on, which says, well, you have an additional stress near the interface.
Those primes mean differentiating.
Sorry. Yeah. And so gamma dot double prime. dy squared. Okay. So the first thing to note is that without this inhomogeneity in the stress, so for d is equal to 0, what you would find is that gamma dot, say, as a function of space, in the y direction across one phase to the other, it'll be particular value, it'll be sharp, and there'll be another value. And it can happen at any stress. The only condition one has is that the stress has to be uniform and the same value in the two phases. If there are no gradient terms and you have a sharp interface, you can get any stress. And so it's an ill-posed. It's an ill-posed problem, and it will give you any number of stresses. Okay, this doesn't seem to be what's happening in the experiments. The experiments give a reproducible stress. So that suggests you need something else. So what happens if you have it non-zero? Then what you would find, far away from the interface, you lie along the homogeneous part of the constitutive curve. At A, and then it'll start to smooth out near the interface and then go off to the other phase. Now you need to solve a differential equation. So you need to solve this equation with boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are that gamma dot at plus or minus infinity is either gamma dot A or gamma dot B, because it has to lie on the flow branch, and if you're far from the interface, it will be no gradient terms. But you also know that far from the interface, all the gradients are equal to 0. So gamma dot prime is equal to 0 far from the interface. Okay, now this also makes it ill-posed, because I've got four boundary conditions, but I've got a second-order differential equation. So what do? You tune the stress until you find that value of the stress for which the boundary conditions become degenerate, and then it's well-posed. Okay, so there will be... Pardon?
You have two. You have four boundary conditions and two equations, so you have two knobs.
In fact, they happen at the same time. It generally happens at the same time.
That looks miraculous.
It does, yeah. It is miraculous, but it shows up.
You understand why it's not miraculous.
Yes, I do. Okay, so it's generally ill-posed, but they generally exist isolated sigma star that satisfy the boundary condition. And that gives you a nice selected stress, which is like the stress that's seen in the experiments.
It has equal errors.
No, it doesn't have equal errors. Okay, I'll write the... So if this is... I'll let D be the most general gradient term I could have. And in fact, you find for this simple model that the selected stress is given by, you just need to integrate this equation, actually. Okay, so if you integrate this equation with these boundary conditions and these boundary conditions, you find an integral relation which says that the selected stress obeys this rule. If D, my gradient terms, did not depend on the strain rate, then it would in fact be exactly equal areas, you can see. If it depends on the strain rate, it's no longer equal areas. So it's generally not equal areas. It depends on the interface. This is different from equilibrium, where your coexistence conditions are independent of the interface because you ignore the surface energy in the thermodynamic limit. But here, everything is crucial and depends on what's happening at the interface. So in fact, to get the numbers right, you need to have your inhomogeneous terms properly done. Depends on the interface. And this makes sense because in the driven system, the stationary state has fluxes running through it. You're shearing it, so you're doing work on it. You're generating heat inside, as was pointed out. The heat's going to get dumped out, and everything comes to a steady state determined by, you know, how it can go through the interface, how it can come out of the sides of the system. So it makes complete sense that it depends on what's going on at the interface. And so in this case, the stress is a field variable, and the strain rate is a density variable. That is, you impose a stress, it's the thing that's the same in the two states because it's homogeneous, and the strain rate adjusts itself. Question, David? No. Okay.
It was a very sharp transition.
If a sharp interface? This is a singular perturbation, actually. So if let's make it independent of strain rate. Now I can absorb D into my spatial dimension. And then it's actually independent of the magnitude of it. So you need it to be there. It doesn't matter how sharp the interface is. It's a singular perturbation, which is enough to resolve the selection issue. Okay. So this is probably not the only way to get a unique selected stress, but it's a very simple way. You don't need to appeal to inventing a new thermodynamic potential. You can just say, well, let's go back to the equations of motion, put the gradient terms in that we know are there, that are generally very difficult to calculate. Once we put them in, you can get a selected solution. Okay. So I really only have time to do the next very interesting thing, which is this is what you find. If your flow curves go that way, there's another family of flow curves, and in fact experiments that I didn't show you, where you could have a flow curve which does that. And what happens if it becomes unstable here, and this one becomes unstable there, and you impose a stress in here? You might imagine that the dynamics say that the system can do this. Now, can it do that? In fact, it can, because let's do our counter-rotating cylinders. And so if I've got phase A organized at the top, which is up here, and I've got B at the bottom, there's B. Okay, if it separates into two states, these states can have the same strain rate. So these rotating cylinders, they can have the same strain rate if they're homogeneous across the gap. So as long as they're homogeneous in the velocity gradient direction, then the strain rates are the same. So gamma dot A is equal to gamma dot B, but the shear stresses are generally different. So you can have sigma A not equal to sigma B. And that, in fact, is okay with momentum balance, because momentum balance, again, says it's zero is the divergence of the stress tensor, and the gradient in this case is parallel to the z direction. So there's the z direction. That doesn't impose any condition on the shear stress. No condition on the shear stress. It does impose conditions on the normal stress, but that will be taken care of by the pressure. Okay, so in addition to phase diagrams where the stress is the same in the two phases and the strain rate is the density variable, you can have it the other way around, where now the strain rate is the same in the two phases and the stress is the density variable. So the identity of what you mean by a field and a density variable have swapped around. And they're, well, first of all, you can do it because of the nature of the force balance. The other thing is we don't have intensive or extensive variables anymore because both of these are intensive variables. So there's no particular reason you need to impose extensivity, which you need to do in equilibrium, in fact, to get the whole phase coexistence. Because you impose extensivity, you ignore the interface between the two phases and you look at the Gibbs potential. So you don't have that working for you anymore. So there's in fact, generally two families of phase diagrams that one can look for coexistence under shear. I should say experimentally, these are the ones that have been found most often. There have been a few found in this orientation, although there has not been enough work yet to really conclusively say that these are completely stable. And I could show you some pictures of it, but I won't.
If you had parallel plates, you couldn't.
You couldn't do this one?
Yeah. Depends on the geometry.
This depends on, if you have parallel plates, you shear it like that. This geometry would correspond to, say, the A phase up there and the B phase down there. So in fact, if you have couette geometry, so this circular couette geometry, you would most likely expect this one, because in the couette geometry, that corresponds to an interface of one and the outer phase of the other. And this has the symmetry of couette. So in those cases where both would happen, which might happen if you're, so if you had constitutive curves that looked like this, which actually shows up in models when you're close to a phase transition, here you might imagine that you could get this or get that. If you put it in a couette device, probably you're going to get this one, although it's a completely open question at the moment as to whether you can find both. Okay, so should I stop about now? Yeah. So one thing one can do with all of this, which I haven't had time to, is once you've got these rules, you could generate phase diagrams in the different spaces of stress, strain rate, and concentration, if you've actually got two-phase equilibria. And you can relate the measured flow curves to these phase diagrams. So there's the way you can, if you only know the flow curves, you can get the phase diagrams. If you only know the phase diagrams, you can get the flow curves. So I'll stop there.
Even though it might be interesting to have some questions from Houston Gears for the last day of discussion, there's some chance that they're not establishing equilibrium.
Yes.
And heavy ions, and maybe
they have been asking questions throughout.
They have, yeah.
You have.
Go ahead.
I have one. Is dissipation really always crucial? Because otherwise you could try to set up an equilibrium discussion with a velocity field and some velocity-dependent interactions and boundary conditions would make things much easier.
If you turn off the dissipation in these, if you were to have an elastic bit which still gave this kind of behavior.
For some system it may be crucial, but for others it may not.
In this case, I don't.
Without dissipation it should be much easier.
Well, and this co-rotational derivative that I told you about, that is a real nasty thing because it makes everything non-integrable in an analytic sense, and you've got to do everything numerically. And that's going to arise whether it's you have dissipation or not. So from a calculational point of view, it doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter, but
well, I
don't know.
You know, If you have a collision, you really have to go to the equations of motions and
redirect
construction. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
At least if dissipation would not be important, you have a complicated geometry, but it's reducible to an equilibrium description. And most of these effects, I could see them emerging in an equilibrium, in a stationary description as well, without dissipation. So it seems not obvious.
It doesn't work, in fact.
No?
And it's because you've got this co-rotational derivative.
Well, one reason you can see straight away it won't work is because you know that if you do maps on an equilibrium problem, you know that you're allowed to work in the Bach thermodynamic limit. Ergo,
right.
The local physics of the interface must eventually go
drop
away.
Out. Yeah.
But you know, in all these problems, in fact, it always stays.
But in fact, you can. It is true. Let's see when you. If you're solving relaxation to equilibrium, in fact, the interface construction is identical to thermodynamics, it turns out, to the normal thermodynamic, because those in that case, you get integrable equations. So if you have any non-zero flow and no dissipation, then you will get non-integrable equations. That's what happens. And then you need to worry about the interface, which is unfortunate.
I'm going to guess that the answer to my question is no, but let me ask it anyway. So in our context, we have these heavy ion collisions, which we may have heard bits and pieces of over the last week.
Yeah.
And we have flow and a phase transition and non-equilibrium, but the words are put together in a different way. In particular, I want to ask, do you have any context in which you have what we have is a flow which corresponds to expansion. So it's a flow, the effect of which is to dilute
dilation
over time. It's an explosion.
So yeah. One flow that we study a lot is extensional flow, where you have something coming out and it's emerging.
So as our systems expand, let me use equilibrium language. As our systems expand, they cool. And so if we have an equilibrium phase transition as a function of temperature, we would expect to go through that as the system expands.
As it expands, that's right.
So the question is, do you have any systems where you can drive a system by expansion, by dilution, by stretching? Cool.
There certainly are. You can have diverging flows,
right,
which will then stretch it.
And
that's
the flow diverges, is there some phase transition that
occurs? Those are always, they're never isotropic.
That's the problem, is they're not.
There's uniaxial extension, which is incompressible fluids. So you don't literally have a change in density.
Yeah, that's right.
I was guessing the answer was no, but I'm just.
Right. But there probably are cases where, as was pointed out, as you shear it, the dissipation induces heat. It raises the temperature, and that could actually. There are cases where you increase the temperature and you go into it, you induce a transition in these complex fluids. So you could get that kind of thing.
It sounds quite forced. I was expecting the answer to be no.
No, it's a bit contrived at the moment to be able to do that. But if we worked hard, we could find something.
Most of the time, the interest is naturally on a steady state situation, which is very different.
I'm sorry, which is
if you're interested in the steady state situation, as is often the case in these fluid systems, that is qualitatively different from what
That's right.
An example of how you could realize it would be to put, let's say, a quantity with a different concentration from the rest in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and free it, and look how it dynamically expands. This would be an analogous situation.
Well, that would be very interesting, actually.
It would be a non-steady state situation.
We are learning a tremendous amount from concentration fluctuation. So if in case where your slow variable comes from big bits in a solvent, then there are fluctuations in the concentration of the big bits, which you pick up, for example, in light scattering, which are turning out to be extremely important, but they're not like huge expansions. But the nearest thing that we find which drives a phase transition is where we have, for example, a dense phase of Peter surfactant, which might be in a nice bordered oniony phase, and then you throw that glob into a solvent,
and then
solvent
it explodes.
Within. And actually, there can be an almost explosive. There can be, but highly nonlinear.
Put oil on water.
Exactly. Well, it's
that's right.
But in fact, what tends to happen is that it's actually sometimes these turn to fracture bubbles because the solvent can find rivers into this stuff, and you can get all the it looks like fracture mechanics, but it's all solvent matter.
Yeah, I think our fluid is complex also, but in a very different sense than all these ones are complex.
Mm-hmm. The viscosity doesn't play a role in your case, right? Does it?
It does.
Oh, because you were worried about heating effects, right? Yeah.
So what happened to the noise terms in the
TEGS? Okay, this was all mean field. You can put noise in, and then you've got to decide, do you use normal fluctuation dissipation theorem noise, or do you try to be realistic and you know, if you do the coarse graining under flow, you can generate corrections to the Langevin noise. But this is an open question at the moment. Well, they violate it or give you an effective FDT with an effective temperature. But this is. At the moment, we just put additive noise. But I think if you try to do the coarse graining in a normalization sense, you will generate multiplicative noise as well.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.